pornography being made fun of, so I revised it. And then Gene revised it again. The fiction that I wanted you to know has been printed the way I wrote it in the book, if you have that. And I thought I had this whole thing settled, but I guess I don't. I'm a little surprised to see this many of you here this morning. You must not have read the schedule, and that's what brought you here this early. It's my job this morning to give you an overview of the book of Mark, and Gene says at the last minute, I don't think that I've ever had a lecture to prepare that gave me as much trouble as this one has, but I'm going to do the best that I can this morning. There are some questions, some pertinent questions that we probably ought to ask at the very beginning. Now, the book of Mark will be formally introduced in another lecture, and so I don't want to spend a great deal of time on it. But so that we might explore the themes that I want to this morning, there are some pertinent questions we need to ask and answer. First off, though the text makes no signature claim, it is universally supposed that it is written by Mark. And this is the same as the John Mark who calls the controversy between Paul and Barnabas. And also, he is called the interpreter of Peter, and many of these ancient sources called this Peter's Gospel. And on this, several of church fathers agree. Irenaeus, Eusebius, Papias, Origen, and Clement all wrote this. Now, some will downplay the connection between Mark and Peter. However, it's interesting to note that the same source that identifies Mark as the author at all also gives us the connection between Mark and Peter. And then it's supposed that he learned this either through the preaching of Peter or perhaps even so far as to being the recipient of dictation by the apostle. Now, by tradition, Mark is also identified as the son of Mary, in whose house the disciples were praying for the release of Peter from prison in Acts chapter 12 and verse 12, and again by tradition in chapter 14 verses 51 and 52, even as the young man who fled naked from the authorities on the evening that Jesus was arrested. And if you read that in context, it's very interesting. I'd heard that tradition before, but if you just read the whole book at once, that incident sort of jumps out at you because it is highly parenthetical. And when you read that, it makes that tradition seem more plausible. Mark was written, most scholars tell us, in the mid-60s A.D., though liberals pushed that date ahead by several decades. And this becomes important to us when we realize that because the advocacy of transmission theories, that is, that the stories came down by oral transmission or reliance upon previous written material, and the belief is, in my judgment, that the farther ahead we can push the date, the more that we can cast doubts on the veracity of the material itself. It is also said and supposed in theory that Mark was written to a largely Gentile audience because, and perhaps even a Latin-speaking one, because there are several what are called Latinisms in the Greek text, whereas Jewish customs are explained thoroughly as though to folks who are unfamiliar with them. And as long as we're talking about this, we need to discuss at least briefly the so-called synoptic problem, which basically says, why are there three Gospels at all? Why is there not just one? Did they rely on each other, or did they rely on another document that we don't have, the infamous and I believe fictitious so-called Q document? As a matter of fact, the synoptic problem itself has proved to be somewhat valuable to those of us who are interested in the text as God's Word, in that it has encouraged a focus on each gospel as an individual document rather than an attempt to create an amalgam of the three. And it is tempting to dismiss the synoptic problem as a brainchild of rampant liberalism, but instead we ought to answer the questions and have some decent answers to those questions. However, I want to point out a couple of ironies in these theories. One such irony is that to the liberal scholar, when he sees, for instance, in the Pentateuch, one continuous document, he says, oh, there must really be four, upon which Moses relied. When it comes to the Gospels and he has four parallel documents, he says, oh, there really must only be one. And I think the irony is glaring. Another irony comes when we consider the matter of parallels versus material that's unique to each gospel. The skeptic looks at parallels and said, oh, they must have copied. But when he sees material that is unique, he says he made a mistake. When we cede all the rules to skeptics, there's no way that we can win. And so if we refuse to do that, really there is no synoptic problem. Each of these synoptic Gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke, were specific documents which stand on their own merits, which were written to individuals that are unique, and the others stand the same. Sequence is only a problem if we assume that the Gospels are A, not really true, B, the product of man alone, and the product of copying from the other, and C, not really inspired of God. I don't believe that sequence is the problem that some will tell us that it is. Now, as so far as the Q document, I won't go through this entire quote, but in the very last part of it from Donald Guthrie, he concedes himself, Q may, after all, only be the creation of modern imagination. Now, we're about ready to examine the themes that I want to talk to you about, but before I do that, we're going to try to look at some themes. However, and this goes to our introduction as well, everything that we can say about linguistic niceties and historical intricacies, those are only the frame, not the masterpiece. Those might help us to understand some of the things we're going to talk about, but the purpose of Mark, as in all the Gospels, is to reveal the Son of God. There are some vistas that are beyond human imagination, beyond human speech and language, and so it is here. We want to think about themes this morning, but I'm not pretending that I'm able in any way to equal what Mark says simply and clearly to us. But perhaps we can bring those things into better focus. And so I'm going to talk to you about themes, but my labeling of themes may not be up to par. Somebody once said the definition of a violin was horsehair being drug across catgut. Well, it's technically correct, and in some cases literally correct, but it doesn't really do justice to it. All right, I want to talk to you about some themes this morning very quickly. The first theme that we find in the book of Mark begins in the very first verse, which labels it as the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God. So we want to think about this theme, that is the proclamation of the Christ as the Son of God. Now, in so saying, he establishes the theme for the rest of the book. Now Mark, though its material is virtually repeated in parallels from the Gospels of Matthew and Luke, is different. Matthew presents Jesus as the Messiah, the fulfillment of Old Testament prophecy. Luke and his orderly account is also different so far as its emphasis and theme. In my judgment, Mark most resembles the Gospel of John, not in the way that it approaches, or rather not in the material that it uses, but in the way that it approaches things. You see, John sets out to prove that Jesus is the eternal and everlasting and divine Son of God. Mark does the same thing, howbeit in a somewhat different manner. It has often been noted that Mark is a gospel that is brimming with energy. In the Gospel of Mark, Jesus scarcely finishes one great deed before beginning another. And has often been noted, the Greek word gaentheos, which is translated either immediately or straightway, is found some 42 times in the text. And in this, some folks see the connection with the Apostle Peter and his restless energy. Instead of focusing on that, however, I want to think about exactly how this pertains to the Son of God issue, the proclamation of the Son of God. You see, this presentation of Jesus has not to do with a personality trait, of himself or of the Apostle Peter or of Mark. But rather it has to do with his absolute knowledge that he was in fact the Son of God, and thus he was doing these great deeds. Explicit claims that Jesus was the Son of God are found 8 times in the book of Mark. And as the book begins, we have no birth narrative. And that's interesting in itself. And some might say the birth narrative would have helped to prove that he was the Son of God, and I would agree that is evidence of his divinity. But you see, with the emphasis being on the Son of God, that is a phrase, that is a notion that is more readily applied to an adult and public Son of God. And so the Gospel of Mark begins with the ministry of John. And so John, chapter 1 and verse 7, identifies Jesus as the Son of God, the one who is mightier than he, whose shoes he's not worthy to stoop down and unloose. It is also significant that almost immediately we have a claim directly from heaven. That is in John chapter 1 and verse 11. This is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. The miracles in the book of John are also proof of his being the Son of God. They speak eloquently to that concept. It has often been noted that given the relative brevity of the book of Mark, miracles are given great prominence, some 19 in number. But I'm not just thinking about the frequency of the miracles, but rather the emphasis that's given to them in their selection and the commentary thereof. Think about it. Jesus is pictured in Mark chapter 4, asleep as the storm rages in absolute confidence in his Father. Later we find that he is able to cast out a demon that his miracle-working disciples had failed in. A woman is healed who but touches the hem of his garment. And he raises the daughter of Jairus. And even heals a Gentile, chapter 7, verses 24 through 30, thus proving that he is the Son of God over all nations. It's also interesting to consider the notion of forgiveness that he claimed for himself. Mark chapter 2 and verse 5, Jesus said, "Son, thy sins be forgiven thee." Now to his critics, this proved to be contentious. Why? Because they recognized that this was beyond the claim of a mere mortal to say that your sins are forgiven you. Were they correct? Indeed they were. Because if he had claimed that, now anybody can make that claim, but he followed up the claim, thus proving the claim true, by healing the man. Had he not been the Son of God, he might have claimed that, but the healing would have been nullified. God would not have allowed it to happen. And so we have the miracles, and so we have the forgiveness of sin. Jesus is proving himself throughout the book to be the Son of God. And because of time, I'm going to skip somewhat ahead if you're trying to follow along and just sort of get down through. Well, I do need to consider this. At the last of the book, let's talk about this. There comes a flurry of activity in the dark hours of the crucifixion. I'll just try to hurry. Which prove him again to be the Son of God. As he's appearing before the high priest in chapter 14, verses 61 and 62, asks him again, "Are you the Son of God?" To which he replies that I am. Now listen to this. There are the three final witnesses in the dark hour of the crucifixion. You have his own claim. Then you have the veil of the temple being rent. And this is in chapter 15. Then in chapter 15 and verse 39, you have the words of an unnamed centurion who says, "Surely this was the Son of God." Chapter 15 and verse 39. And so the first theme that you want to think about is established in the first verse and runs virtually throughout the book. Jesus Christ is the Son of God. The second great theme that we want to think about this morning is similar to the first one. That is that he is the Son of Man. Now this phrasing is not unique to Mark. We find it throughout the New Testament. But it is especially interesting, not just again the frequency, but the theme of the Son of Man, in contrast to the theme of the Son of God. After all, had Jesus not been the Son of Man, there never would have been a question about his being the Son of God. It is the incarnation that makes this question important to us. And it establishes the Christology of the book of Mark as well, the Son of God and the Son of Man. And it's interesting to look throughout the book and to read comments of various scholars who always want to point out that despite the brevity of the book of Mark, we have all these vivid details. And again, there are some who will inevitably go back and talk about the Apostle Peter, and they will talk about his ability to think in details. Well, while that may be, the vivid details in the book of Mark are not a testament to the prowess of the aged apostle as a storyteller. Rather, they are a testament to his being the Son of Man. The purpose of such details is not to reveal the storyteller, but to reveal the Son of Man. And so what we are claiming in this is that Mark is doing something that is quite similar, again, to what John had done, albeit in a different way. John's approach was somewhat philosophical, whereas Mark's is more practical. And to illustrate what I'm talking about, I'd like to go back to Exodus chapter 6 and notice something that's said in verse 3, and I believe it's a similar concept. God is speaking to Moses on this occasion, and he says, "By my name, or rather, I revealed myself unto Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob by my name, God Almighty. But by my name, Yahweh, was I not known unto them." Now, the name Yahweh was known upon the earth before God said that. So what did he mean? As we continue with the story of his servant Moses, we find out what he means. He intended to reveal himself personally to Moses through his close communion with him and by the revelation of his law through him. In much the same way, God is going to, through the writing of the inspired Mark, reveal Jesus as the Son of Man through his close communion with mankind and through the teachings of the Master. Let's look at some specifics. In Mark chapter 3, we have an account of the healing of a man whose hand was withered. And I want you to notice some of the human appeal in this section. What do we read about? We read about Jesus and his boldness as he healed this man openly. And then we read of his anger at the hard-heartedness of those who opposed him. Now, while we recognize that righteous anger is a divine attribute, at the same time, there is something here that appeals to us. We respect the courage of Jesus, and we take note of his anger. Why? Because it helps us to understand that Jesus Christ, as a man, experienced a full range of human emotions. And while this does nothing to detract from his being the divine Son of God, it shows that he is also the Son of Man. He was frustrated, hurt, joyous, and happy, just as any other man was, though he was not just any other man. And in Mark chapter 4, I find it most interesting to look at the calming of the storm in light of the Son of Man theme. In verse 38, Mark gives us a detail that the other Gospels do not, and that is that he was asleep. And in a moment, we'll think about a theme connected with that so far as the Son of Man and his absolute trust in God. But notice that detail, what it tells us about it. It tells us he was fatigued, and that's a thoroughly human quality. Now, there are some that look at incidents like this, including this one, and they see this as the evidence of a miraculous divine faith. I don't believe that's the case. Jesus was doing something that every one of his disciples was capable of doing. We know that because in verse 40, he chastises them for their lack of faith. He would not have done this if this were a quality, being the Son of God. Now, obviously, stilling the sea doesn't fall under that heading. But the absolute trust in his Father was something that any disciple could have attained. And so we have the healing of a withered hand. We have the calming of the sea. Let's talk about two other incidents. One of those in Mark chapter 2 and verse 28. And this is where Jesus claimed to be the Lord of the Sabbath. But it's interesting when we read that he did not claim as Lord of the Sabbath that he should simply override the Old Testament law. As the Son of Man, which he claimed to be in chapter 2 and verse 28, he was submissive to it, though he reminded them that he was also the Son of God and thus the Lord of the Sabbath. And there's one other theme that helps us to understand that concept, and that is throughout the middle of the book of Mark, we have the issue of service. And so in chapter 8 and verse 31, Jesus begins to show his disciples how that he must suffer and die. And throughout chapters 9 and 10, he demonstrates to them the concept of service as the Son of Man. Culminating in chapter 10 and verse 45, where he says to his disciples, the Son of Man came not to be served, but rather to serve. Now we have one final theme. That is the presentation. The presentation through preaching. Now, I don't mean to suggest to you that the book of Mark, in my reading, has revealed a great deal of the actual words so far as teaching of Jesus. It doesn't. We have no great three-chapter record of a sermon such as Matthew records, or an abbreviated version in Luke. And as some have noted, Mark is noted for its lack of parables. I believe there are only four in the entire book. So again, it is not the frequency that we want to think about. Rather, it is the connection. It is the power. It is the consistency between lifestyle and proclamation. And you know, when we've just concluded with themes as grand as the Son of God, as thorough as the Son of Man, the notion of preaching might just seem pedestrian to us by comparison. It's not. It is through that humble tool and through the humble tools of preachers that God intended for these other great themes to even be known by the world. At the beginning of Mark, in chapter 1, you find preaching mentioned on five occasions. Chapter 1 and verse 4, John came preaching. Chapter 1 and verse 7 is preaching of the Christ. Chapter 1 verse 14, Jesus is, rather his ministry is marked by his preaching. And then the latter two occasions we have him teaching in the synagogues and then preaching throughout all Galilee. And that theme is rather impossible to miss. But as you continue on, you also see that there is an issue of timing with the preaching. In chapter 7, verse 36, Jesus warned those who heard him, you are not to preach before the time. Chapter 8 and verse 30, he gives the same warning to his disciples. Chapter 3, verses 11 and 12, the demons were not to proclaim him at all. Then, finally, in chapter 16 and verse 15, the command comes to preach to the entire world. It seems, by looking at the timing, looking at the ministry of John and his preaching, seeing the emphasis that Jesus gave to his own preaching, that it's impossible to miss this. But I want to spend just a moment talking to you about what many believe is the crux of the entire book. And that is Mark's account of the same incident that we read about in Matthew's gospel in chapter 16. And that is chapter 8 and verse 29. It is on this occasion when I believe that all three of these themes come together. At this point, Jesus has asked, "What do men say about me, and what do you say?" And Simon Peter replies, "Art thou Christ, the Son of God." Now, when he said that, and when Jesus authorized the preaching that would accompany it, we begin to see that through preaching, these other themes are going to be known. And as we close the book, and I hurried so much, I actually got done early. Surprise, surprise. But as we close the book, we recognize that these great themes are not just to be found in the book of Mark, but also to be loved. There we find that Jesus is absolutely the Son of God and full of power. He's the Son of Man, the servant of all. But he is also the sermon that will save the world. I believe that is the theme of the book of Mark. Thank you.